Hi, Allison.
Hi, Max.
Have you started planning about how you're going to get to the live show?
I'm going to run with excitement.
Yes. When is it again?
September 24th.
Yes.
At the Complex in Los Angeles.
Yes.
But you know what? I'm kind of sad.
Why is that?
Because we're getting towards the end of season two.
That is true. That is true.
But then I get to look forward to season three and all the cool things we're going to do then.
Listen, there's a new logo coming.
No.
We've got more stickers coming. We've got big plans for more field pieces.
Yes.
More interactive content. More content for the podcast itself. We have a new podcast coming out too.
Ugh, there's nothing
so
to be sad about.
Much planned.
Hello.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name is Max.
I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm going to be talking about Georgina Beyer.
This week, I will be telling you the amazing story of Martha Richard.
Oh my gosh.
Get ready.
Okay.
So she was born Martha Bettenfield in France on August 15th, 1889. She was the daughter of a brewer. They were poor. She would just walk the streets until she was able to move to Paris on her own a few years later. Making ends meet. She was a student and she loved languages. She learned to speak English, Spanish, and German in addition to French.
Wow.
And at 14, apparently, she became an apprentice to a tailor. But in 1905, when she was 16, she just registered as a prostitute and was issued a card given to those prostitutes known to be carrying venereal diseases.
Oh, no.
So we don't really know much until then, but in 1912, with the encouragement of her not yet husband, Henri Ricker, she got her pilot's license.
Wait, what?
Because, you know, casual days.
Yeah.
Flying around.
Sure.
During her time she spent at the airfield, she met a Russian nicknamed Zozo, and the two became lovers. And Martha, she really wanted some kind of fame for her flying. She flew her plane from Paris to Burgundy, then secretly put it on a train to the countryside outside of Zurich, Switzerland, then flew her plane into the city and claimed to be the first female pilot in the world to fly such a long trip.
Oh, my God.
And she was actually approved this title until somebody started doing some
right.
research. And then she tried to offer her services to the French government during World War One as
Which
a
services?
Pilot.
Oh, okay.
As a pilot. But they were denied.
Oh, no, because she lied?
I mean, I don't really know,
right,
but if
they were
you...
just denied.
I don't know. Instead, she was married to Henri in 1915, and he was
Great.
A fish merchant and a pilot in World War One. He helped to teach her grammar and horse riding before going off to the front.
What an eclectic
I know.
knowledge just base like... for this woman.
But it comes in handy
oh,
because
good.
Get this, okay? So then Henri dies. Less than a month after his death, though, Zozo, this Russian pilot, I mean, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Z-O-Z-O, Zozo,
what
that's all I've
be?
Got.
Right.
I'm going with it.
Sure.
He persuades the French spy master, Captain Georges Ledoux, the same man who recruited Mata Hari.
I know that name.
To recruit Marta for what was referenced to as, quote, a patriotisme horizontal, a.k.a. go sleep with some people and get information.
Oh, my God.
So according to her autobiography, she was initially horrified, but finally persuaded. She was sent to Spain to seduce Baron von Kron, a submarine specialist with a glass eye. So like, it's already a James Bond movie, okay?
Literally.
It's writing itself at this point. She recounts this experience in her autobiographies by saying that when the moment came, she had a stiff drink, laid back, and said under her breath, Vive la France. Another source claims that Krohn fell in love with Marta and they just had a continued affair and it was all fine
sure.
and mutual.
Vive la France.
Von Krohn then recruited her for Germany, making her a double agent. So he says that he shipped her to Argentina in 1917 with 8 thermoses of poisonous weevils to poison the wheat in the ship's hold, which was meant for the Allies.
Uh-huh.
She, of course, drowned all the weevils in the sink.
Of course.
This story is maybe not exactly true, but it is fun. So who knows?
This is the rest of her life so far.
I know, for real. It's such a drama. Another source says that she was given invisible ink to write down her findings of the French
mm-hmm.
or for the French. And when she arrived back to France and showed the ink to her superiors and informed them that she had successfully become involved with Krohn, they gave her false information to give back to him and sent her back to Spain. So then she reestablished her relationship and then learned that he had also been involved with Mata Hari.
Oh.
So faking anger, Marta threatened to end her relationship with Kron, and she was able to pull him in even more, gaining more access to even more secret information. She continued to pass all the info to France, which allegedly includes revelations about German submarine development. And then she just grew tired of this deception and pressure of being a spy. And so she returns home to France. But she had, by this point, or maybe earlier, we don't know, developed real love for von Kron.
Oh my gosh.
The man that she was charged with spying with. So after the war officially ended, she told him of her deception. But he didn't do anything about it.
Sure.
So I guess love conquers all.
Right.
The war's over. It's all fine. You
like
spied on me,
just,
but we're in
like,
love.
Washed her hands and
yeah,
was
just
like,
I'm
spying.
Done, but I love you. So like, forgive me, maybe. So she returns to Paris to take up her old hobby of flying again, casual, which gives her entry into the British colony section of Paris, where there she meets Thomas Crompton, a director of the Rockefeller Foundation in France. They married in 1926, which effectively makes her a British citizen, since dual citizenship wasn't really possible at the time. And Crompton, too, died early in their marriage. And then Marta was just generally ignored by the French government after World War
I. Oh,
even
no.
though she'd done good spy work for them, she'd also drawn some unfavorable attention due to her close relationship with von Kron. So until Georges Ledoux, Jeanette says, who literally sucks, decided to write a series about famous spies he had recruited in an effort to receive a promotion. He started with the treacherous Mata Hari, and then for the second volume, he wanted to show a heroic French woman and chose Marta.
Right.
The book he wrote was almost entirely made up. And according to a report in the New York Times, it was Ledoux who changed her last name to Richard in the book. But other accounts say that she changed it when she began spying out of respect for her first husband. Whatever. The book became a huge success. And instead of denying the claims of Ledoux, though, Marta instead went on a lecture circuit with the book and then fabricated her first memoir in 1935.
Oh, my God.
She became an acclaimed heroine of France. And you can just go buy the book that Ledoux wrote about her in Barnes & Noble. In the nonfiction section, I guess, though maybe it should be in the fiction section. Who knows?
Oh, my Lord.
I mean, she already lied about flying her plane to Switzerland. Like,
right.
What else is this woman up to? It's nuts.
She is crazy. I'm obsessed, but she's
right?
crazy.
So in 1933, she then receives the Legion d'Honneur, but apparently this was actually an award given posthumously to her husband in regards to his work with the Rockefeller Foundation. And so we really don't know if it was for him or if it was for her work during the war, because she wrote an autobiography in 1935, but it was later proven that she exacerbated the fabrications in Ledoux's book in her own autobiography.
Oh, my God.
There was a movie made about her in 1937, which went even further to solidify her as this heroine for France.
Right.
That she did take part in the French resistance during World War II, but we don't really know what she did. All the sources just basically say the same thing, which is, quote, she joined the resistance at the right time, end quote. Whatever that means. No one knows.
Did she write that herself?
What are you doing? We don't know. You're making up lies. It seems like she became a type of madam who would procure girls for Germans and then learn secrets from them. So kind of like she's training girls to do what she did in World War
I,
like a madam, but of prostitute spies. I don't really know.
The madam of prostitute
now
spies.
Now then, after this, things get a little weird because they're not weird already.
After this.
So now things get weirder. She was elected to the municipal council in Paris in 1945, and she was encouraged by a resistance group who considered her a war hero due to her spying. And there was a law going around to outlaw prostitution, and allegedly at first Marta was against this law and tried to convince the municipal council to go with it, but they refused. But then she presented her own plan for closing the brothels, and it passed, and the brothels were closed within 3 months. So then she began a campaign to end prostitution throughout the whole country. Cool, I guess. Then people come to find out that she had been a prostitute as a teenager, so many people are like, what the heck? You're a giant hypocrite. What's going on? In 1948, there arose more controversy surrounding her nationality because when she married Thomas Crompton, she became a British citizen. So her election to office in France is technically illegal.
Oh my God.
So a French magazine denounced her services to the nation and accused her of involvement with organized crime and covering up crimes. But Jacques Dallaire, the inspector of national safety, inquired into these accusations, found them to be false. She passed away in 1982 at the age of 93. She never succeeded in regaining her French citizenship. But a TV film was made about her in 2011, which I have got to watch
because
this is like the craziestness, random assortment. What a lady. What a life.
It's just ridiculous, honestly.
Totally nuts. Totally nuts. Whew. That's Marta Richard.
She joined the resistance at the right time.
That's all you need to know.
Well, okay. Thank you so much.
Of course. Anytime.
What a story. All right. So, Georgina Beyer.
Mm-hmm.
Georgina Beyer became the world's first transsexual mayor in 1995 in New Zealand.
New Zealand is first in everything.
Literally. She was born George Bertrand in 1957 at Wellington Hospital, New Zealand, and her parents are Jack and Nolene Bertrand. She is of European and Maori descent. She was named after her maternal grandfather, Lieutenant Colonel George Bertrand, who was second in command in the Maori battalion.
Wow.
Her parents divorced in 1962, and her mother remarried shortly after to Colin Beyer. They didn't have a smooth marriage either, and Georgina was actually sent to Wellesley College boarding school, where she actually tried to commit suicide.
Mm.
She hopped around schools for a time before officially leaving school at 16 against the wishes of her mother.
Wow.
To pursue acting.
Whoa! Didn't see that one coming.
In her 20s, she became part of the Wellington gay nightclub scene, initially as a singer and drag queen performer, and then as a sex worker. During a trip to Australia, she was unfortunately attacked by four men, an experience which she refers to as her defining moment.
Mm.
And it was in 1984 that she underwent sex confirmation surgery at the age of 22.
Wow.
So she lived in Australia for a time before returning to New Zealand to continue to seek work as an actor. And she was actually quite successful and received a GAFTA, which was at the time was the New Zealand equivalent of an Emmy for her work in Jules Darl in 1987. She moved to the small conservative town of Charterton, where she initially became the local news presenter and part of the inaugural breakfast crew on Paul Henry's radio station. It was when she moved to Charterton that she actually began her government service. First, she won election to a local school board, and then in 1995, she was elected as mayor of Charterton. And what's cool about it is that Charterton was traditionally very conservative, and she won it as a more progressive candidate. And she served in that role for 5 years until 2000, becoming the world's first transsexual mayor. She ran for parliament in 1999 as the Labour Party's candidate for the Wairarapa electorate. So sorry if I'm mispronouncing that. And much to the surprise of political commentators, she won. She became the world's first transsexual member of parliament.
Wow.
She ran again in 2002 and won again with an even greater majority. I believe she won the first time with just over 3,000 votes. The second time she won with more than doubled it to over 6,000 votes. In a 2002 interview, she said, "I get asked questions no other politician would ever have to answer regarding the surgery. You know, did it hurt? Or when you have sex now as a woman, is it different than how you had sex as a man? Well, honey, obviously."
Hmm.
So when members of parliament are newly elected, they are given the floor for 10 minutes to introduce themselves to the rest of parliament.
That's so cool.
And so here's an excerpt from her speech. "Mr. Speaker, I can't help but mention the number of firsts that are in this parliament. Our first Rastafarian, Nandora Tanzos. Our first Polynesian woman. And yes, I have to say it, I guess I am the first transsexual in New Zealand to be standing in this House of Parliament. This is a first not only in New Zealand, ladies and gentlemen, but also in the world. This is an historic moment, and we need to acknowledge that this country of ours leads the way in so many aspects.
Mm-hmm.
We have led the way for women getting the vote. We have led the way in the past, and I hope we will do so again in the future in social policy and certainly in human rights. Do you want to go to New Zealand with me?"
I always want to go to New Zealand.
Oh my God.
Anytime.
"Can we please go, and we can go to all the places where they film Lord of the Rings? And then we can go to Parliament and we can see where she made this speech."
Perfect. I love it.
In 2004, she spoke at UNIQ, Queer Students Association National Conference at the Waikato University at Hamilton, where she reiterated her support for the Civil Union Bill, which would establish the institution of civil union for same-sex and opposite-sex couples.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the bill and the companion bill that were passed along with it guaranteed the same rights to couples, whether they were married in a civil union or in a de facto partnership. And even though the bill didn't end up passing, Georgina spoke at the conference that she feared gay marriage would not be legal in New Zealand for at least 20 years.
Wow.
And she also spoke of her fears that gay and lesbian New Zealanders were facing an incredibly turbulent time since the late 80s. Marriage equality, on a side note, was actually achieved in New Zealand 10 years after the fact. While in Parliament, she helped pass the Prostitution Reform Act, which decriminalized prostitution and protected sex workers as well as their clients.
Mm.
She also struggled with the seabed and foreshore legislation that came to Parliament. The legislation concerned the ownership of the country's foreshore and seabed, which many Maori groups argue was theirs. And they have, right, and still to this day argue is theirs, and that they have, right, the rightful claim to it based on the Treaty of Waitangi from 1840. And Georgina was torn between her membership of Parliament and her Maori heritage.
Right.
She did ultimately decide in favor of the legislation, and the foreshore and seabird were claimed as ownership of the crown. In early 2004, Georgina announced that she would not run again in 2005. However, she changed her mind after a rally was held by the conservative Destiny Church, and she believed that the message of such rallies must be opposed. So she ran again for the Labour Party, mm-hmm, and she won, and effectively resigned from Parliament in 2007, so 2 years later.
Yeah.
She's still alive today, although she's not in government anymore. She chronicled her life in Change for the Better, the story of Georgina Beyer, in 1999. In 2003, a film was made about her life on PBS called Georgie Girl. And in 2006, she was the keynote speaker at the International Conference on LGBT Human Rights in Montreal.
It's amazing.
Absolutely. She's still alive and kicking today.
Keep it up.
Yes, ma'am. The Bitchery of History is brought to you by Audible.com. You can download a free book and start a free trial by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
This week I'm going to suggest The Memory Keeper's Daughter by Kim Edwards. It is a novel of parallel lives, familial secrets, and the redemptive power of love. But the story is basically there's twins born one night in the 60s in Kentucky, and one is healthy, and then the doctor sees that the other one has Down syndrome, and he immediately sends the nurse away with that child to put it in a home and promise to never tell the mother of this. But then the nurse, like, runs away with the baby to another city and raises her as her own. So then you have, like, these two families and they're trying to find each other. So pretty interesting.
Yeah. All right.
Help pass the time in traffic. Get that at audibletrial.com/bitchery.
Hey, friends. If you're enjoying this podcast, you know what to do. Look down at that phone, that Zoom, that iPod you're listening to this podcast on, and give us a rating or a review. Those ratings and reviews, they go a long way to helping other people find this podcast, which really, it helps us keep doing the podcast. Thank you. Today in history?
Mm-hmm. Today in history. August 15th, 1970, Patricia Palinkas became the first woman to play professionally in an American football game as a place kick holder for the Orlando Panthers.
Wow. And then on August 18th, 1920, Tennessee became the last state to ratify the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which gave women the right to vote.
And then on August 19th, 1692, in Salem, Massachusetts, five people, one woman and four men, including a clergyman, are executed after being convicted of witchcraft.
Oh, my Landa. We must do the Salem witch trials.
I know it.
Oh.
Term of the week?
Term of the week. This week, you suggested that we should talk about the hijab,
mm-hmm,
its appropriateness, and you found something about what you should do if it gets ripped off in public.
Yes. Yeah. I was just scrolling through the internet, killing time one day, and I just came upon a post that was kind of about what you should do and what your reaction should be. And there were some people offering some great tips. So if you do happen to see that happening, one, that's horrible and terrifying, and I don't even want to think about it because that's so rude.
It's literally one of the rudest things you could do.
But they did say if you are a man, it's best to look away if you can, out of respect. Or man or woman, offer them something if you have something that they can cover their head or their hair with. And so if you're a man, you offer from far away, not looking away. So that's kind of the steps to take. But I just wanted to bring it up because it seems to be a hot button topic, right, even among women and even among feminists. And I think my stance is that it's not my duty, at least, to tell other women how to live their lives.
Absolutely.
And if they feel, or if there's a woman who feels that it is her duty to wear it, then go, girl.
Exactly right.
You do you.
Right.
I think if there was someone who was feeling truly oppressed by it, in this country anyway, they would have the ability, I would hope, to express that in some form or fashion. If they needed help, it's a religious symbol and it's not your place to rip it off of someone.
Exactly right. Telling someone not to wear a hijab or passing laws saying that you can't wear a hijab or a niqab or a burqa or any of the other various coverings is, I guess, if you want to think of it as trying to like liberate the woman, if you're going to use that mentality, then you're putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound. Like, you're not fixing the cause of the problem. You're fixing the
look of it.
The look
really
of it. Because I think what you're worried about, or what I hope you're worried about, is the freedom of the woman to express themselves, right? And so instead of saying, okay, I'm going to rip your covering off, instead saying, okay, what can I do to create an environment where if you want to take it off, you have the freedom to take it off without fear of reprisal from anybody.
Right. And I think I was reading a long time ago, I think it was in a National Geographic article, but I could be misremembering where I was reading this, but it was a woman who I think generally wore a burqa most days, wore full covering, and she said it was very liberating because she felt that then people weren't looking at her as I feel sometimes people look at me as as a woman or just for my body or whatever the case may be. But she was said, you know, now it's just me. And I know that if they're looking at me or talking to me, then it's about who I am as a person. Right. And there's a great comic as well. It's two women passing each other, one in full covering and one in, I forget exactly what she's wearing, but shorts and a tank top maybe. And their thought bubbles are, you know, look what that woman is wearing. She's so oppressed. Both of them are thinking that.
Oh, I think I've seen that.
Yeah. Or they're thinking very similar thoughts to each other. So again, it's just realizing it's not your place to tell someone how to live their life, but to create an environment where there is safety and freedom of expression for all people everywhere.
Absolutely.
So do we have a cause for this week?
Yeah. So I was thinking, since we're talking about hijabs and what you can do instead of, you know, as an alternative to ripping someone's hijab off, trying to free a woman, instead, maybe support a cause like charterforcompassion.org. They work to establish and sustain cultures of compassion locally and globally through diverse sectors: arts, business, education, the environment, healthcare, interfaith communities, peace, restorative justice, science and research, social justice, social service, science and research, and women and girls. And the heart of their work is working with cities to identify issues of concern that make their communities uncomfortable places in which to live. So helping to kind of combat the things that we were just talking about.
Fantastic. Yeah. And I was seeing something on their homepage, charterforcompassion.org, that was asking Muslim women or women of faith to wear the hijab as a sign of solidarity and interfaith awareness. So that's kind of a neat idea as well.
Absolutely. We will post that link on the Facebook page.
Yeah, that would be great.
So again, what's that website?
charterforcompassion.org.
Fantastic. So The Bitchery of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions.
Let me see if I get this right. We're on Facebook. Just search The Bitchery of History. Mm-hmm. Twitter is @BitcheryPodcast. And Instagram is just The Bitchery of History.
That's correct.
And always Patreon/Ursula Major.
Yes, ma'am. We're just for $1 a podcast, $5 a podcast for that sticker of the month club. You can help us make this podcast happen. As always, such a great and amazing And so thankful, shout out to our team here on the Bitchery of History. And they are
Kim,
Jeanette,
Steph,
Keegan,
Jess,
Dan,
Sydney.
And as always,
bitches get stuff done.